Welcome. Can I have your attention, please? Well, welcome and good evening to Naomi Klein's second Miliband lecture, which is this evening entitled Economic Terror, Deep Democracy, Street Reports from Argentina and South Africa. The format will be different from last week's Peacock Theatre lecture because Naomi will speak for about 35 to 40 minutes. Tony Giddens will respond for about 10 to 15 minutes. Naomi will then add a few additional remarks, and then you are welcome to speak. Like last time, I'll take questions, not statements, in clusters of five, which gives you a better opportunity to raise issues. And we would like to finish by about eight, but if there are lots of questions, we can run on a little longer. I introduced Naomi at some length last time, so I'll be briefer this time, and she probably needs very little introduction. She's, of course, an award-winning journalist, author of the now very famous No Logo, which is available in over 25 languages and has been a bestseller around the world. By contrast, Tony Giddens, well, we don't know who he is, but I can remind you that he is familiar to you all, of course, as director of the LSE, author of numerous books, too many to mention, in particular author of the very influential Third Way books, which again have been sold all over the world and have had a big impact, and more recently the author of Where Now for New Labour, probably sold more or less in the UK only in this case. Naomi Klein has just published Fences and Windows, which I don't know whether it's available outside, but probably in the bookshop, well, for sure in the bookshop since I saw it in the window. And she is currently working on a major documentary focused on Argentina and South Africa. And she'll be drawing some of her examples and material from that work experience and that engagement this evening. So join with me to welcome Naomi Klein and then Tony Giddens.
Thank you so much, Professor Held, and Professor Giddens. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here at the LSE this month. When Professor Held asked me for the name of this speech and what I was going to talk about, it was before I knew that I was going to be lucky enough to have Professor Giddens here as my discussant. So I've had to have a slight rejigging where I talked about South Africa in my first lecture, and in this lecture we might rename it The Third Way and Argentina. Now, as you all have realized by now, I'm from North America, which means that compared to most of you here, I'm not very well brought up at all, really raised by wolves, frankly. But even in this shabby context, my mother did manage to teach me that when you're a guest in someone's house, you should be polite to them, which is why I have been a little bit anxious about this lecture, because I've been racking my brain, and I don't quite see a way to talk about the topic before us tonight, either economic terror or deep democracy, in ways that are less than flattering, let's just say, about the Third Way, and in fact, the tremendous influence of this man over here, your esteemed director. Now, I am well aware that Professor Giddens is quite used to having the Third Way openly debated and in fact thrives in the fray. But I still couldn't get over this idea that it was rude to insult your host. But this is what saved me. I started to do some research into the Miliband program, which is what brought me here to the LSE. And I discovered something very interesting, which is that even though I was asked here by Professor Held, and even though my letter of invitation was graciously signed by Professor Giddens, and of course I am most grateful to both of them, my real host here actually isn't them, it's you. The Miliband program comes not from the LSE faculty, but from an LSE student. Now, I know that some of you know this remarkable story, but for those of you who don't, I'm going to give you a brief synopsis because I think it's quite relevant, actually, to the topic tonight. Ralph Miliband, first as a student and then as a member of the faculty here at the LSE, spent his life arguing that the true goal of a left party should be to advance socialism as an alternative to capitalism. In fact, a wonderful writer, he described capitalist society this way once: as a conflict-ridden, growingly authoritarian and brutalized social system, poisoned by its inability to make humane use of the immense resources capitalism has itself brought into being. Now, near the beginning of his career, Ralph Miliband laid out these arguments in his incredibly influential book, Parliamentary Socialism. And he developed them through his final book, Socialism for a Skeptical Age. And in between, he devoted himself to the ideal of building socialist movements founded on principles of deep democracy in the journal he founded and edited, The Socialist Register. When Ralph Miliband died, Anthony Giddens had not yet written The Third Way. And yet Ralph Miliband always had plenty to say about the Labour Party's drift to more pragmatic electoral positions. For example, in 1961, amidst fierce debates about the direction of the party, he called, quote, the grand reconciliation between the labor movement and contemporary capitalism the essence of revisionism. Now, despite such unfashionable views, or perhaps because of these unfashionable views, he was extraordinarily loved by his students here at the LSE. And when he died in 1994, one of his former LSE pupils decided that a good way to honor the man was to keep his intellectual tradition alive here at the LSE. He or she made an anonymous donation, a donation which formed the foundation of the Miliband program. So as a Miliband fellow, you can see why I say that my true host isn't actually on stage with me, but perhaps somewhere out there with you. And it's for this reason that no matter what good manners or good upbringing would dictate, I feel I have something of a sacred duty to take on some aspects of the Third Way tonight. I will also try, in some small way, some humble way, to build on Ralph Miliband's tireless critique of the ravages of capitalism and on his deep belief in democracy, his insistence that the true goal of any social movement should be more than voting, but, and I quote again, maximum self-government in the productive process and every sphere of life. Indeed, Ralph Miliband never joined the Communist Party and argued that the failure of so many experiments in socialist governing were due to the fact that the elites who implemented these policies never took democracy seriously, and so power centralized and bureaucratized, divorcing state ownership on paper from genuinely public and democratic control of state resources in practice. The subject of my lecture tonight is how social movements are attempting to reverse that unfortunate divorce between public ownership and public control, and to stage a long overdue reconciliation between these two forces and ideas. Now, my starting premise, as I argued in my lecture last week, is that we are currently facing not a crisis of globalization, but a global crisis of faith in representative democracy. The world over, democratic governments are failing to deliver on the policies they campaigned on and introducing privatization and deregulation policies that are wildly unpopular, but which we are told there is no alternative to. This process has led to a tremendous concentration of wealth at the top and a loss of control over access to public resources at the bottom. Now, this point of view, which used to be held just by wingy left academics and activists like me, just this Sunday, arrived on the cover of the New York Times magazine. And it was written by a rather mainstream economist, an article by Paul Krugman. Krugman documents the staggering inequalities of the American economy and wonders aloud just how little of the enormous wealth generated under Bill Clinton's boom has ultimately trickled down. And he asks an important question. He asks how an economic failure of this magnitude cannot also be a democratic failure. He quotes Kevin Phillips, author of the book Wealth and Democracy. And Kevin Phillips says, either democracy must be renewed with politics brought back to life, or wealth is likely to cement a new and less democratic regime, plutocracy by some other name. Now, Krugman's article ends with a conclusion surprising for the New York Times, actually surprising for Krugman, but which would have made Ralph Miliband proud, I believe. He wrote this: we may become a country in which the big rewards are reserved for people with the right connections, in which ordinary people see little hope of advancement, in which political involvement seems pointless because in the end, the interests of elite, are always, I'm going to start that again. We may become a country in which the big rewards are reserved for people with the right connections, in which ordinary people see little hope of advancement, in which political involvement seems pointless, because in the end, the interests of the elite always get served. Now, I'm going to be talking as well tonight about how citizens around the world, with a particular emphasis on Argentina. Phew, I thought I was out of time. Damn. He scares me. Are attempting to remedy this state of affairs by building alternatives to their discredited representative democracy. Now, these movements that I'm referring to began purely as protests, a rejection of the policies of privatization and deregulation. But today, they are quickly moving beyond rejectionism and are starting to articulate, beneath the media radar, a positive, policy-driven political agenda, a process of decentralization and direct participatory democracy. Now, I want to stress that these demands for participatory democracy, many of them originating in South America but already spreading to Europe and North America, are not nostalgic throwbacks, but are a new political movement. Genuine decentralized participatory democracy represents a radical alternative to the centralized state solutions traditionally proposed by left political parties, parties which have too often believed that there is no problem that nationalization and better central planning cannot solve. But these movements for participatory democracy are also, I believe, a clear alternative to, and indeed a rejection of, the logic of the third way. Why? Because the third way deals with the alienation that so many people feel towards an unaccountable and centralized public sphere by turning to the private sector for rescue, for expertise. These new movements reject this solution, yet they share much of the third way's critique of the failed welfare state. They recognize, for instance, that for the most vulnerable in our society, the state is more a force of control and repression than of protection and social support. They are willing to see that for most people, the primary demand is not for more state control over their lives, but less control. After all, if you want to hear the hunger for a more decentralized understanding of democracy, talk to an American teacher who is having standardized testing rammed down their throat by a half-literate politician. If you want to hear more anger at central control, talk to a doctor or a nurse working in a public hospital managed by a corporate executive who doesn't know a thing about healthcare but can talk about best practices and management models all night long. Movements for participatory democracy are not afraid to recognize that the common refrain coming from our schools, our hospitals, our rural communities is not a demand for better central planning, but a bloody rage at centralization and a deep desire to be free to draw on the skills, expertise, and creativity that resides in every community and in every workplace. When that hunger for deeper day-to-day democracy goes unfed, other solutions easily fill the gap. Maybe those solutions are xenophobia. Maybe they're tax cuts. I believe that the failure of these centralized state solutions has made it relatively easy to sell third way style privatizations as the panacea to the problem of a cut-off state. But the social movements that I'm talking about have a different vision for a way out of this democratic crisis. Rather than selling off or outsourcing our public resources and assets, they are attempting to rekindle our collective faith in democracy and in the public sphere by doing something quite novel, by transforming the public sphere into a site of genuine democracy and community control. Now, before I get into these alternatives, I want to explain why I believe that the policies of the third way, particularly as they relate to privatization, even if it was not their intention, have intensified rather than alleviated our democratic crisis. Now, Professor Giddens has argued that third way politics seeks to transform the government and the state to make them as effective and quick on their feet as many sectors of business have become. Many governments have attempted to achieve this efficiency, this speed on their feet, through privatizations of basic services and through public-private partnerships. Now, I see at least three clear problems with the application of this theory in practice. The first is that being quick on your feet means being able to respond to changing circumstances with relative ease. And yet the key demand coming from the service industries bent on privatization is consistency. Vivendi and Suez don't want to take over a municipal water system unless they can be guaranteed contracts of up to 40 years. They also don't want the rules that they establish now to be locked in, which in practice means that the state becomes far slower on its feet, less responsive than it was before privatization. A good example of this is the British Rails. George Monbiot reported 2 weeks ago in The Guardian that the Blair government may be on the verge of trading away its right to fully reverse the privatization of the rails. He quotes a little red passage in a document published by the Department of Trade and Industry and says that in order to comply with WTO rules on services, the government may be forced to, quote, fully bind the existing regime for road and rail, in effect, locking privatization in indefinitely, preventing renationalization, regardless of whether the public demands it, regardless of whether it votes for it. This is, in fact, what happened in Cochabamba, Bolivia. In 2000, there was a popular uprising against water privatization. And the fact that water privatization had meant 50% increase in the rates for water. And these protests led the U.S. company, water company Bechtel, to pull out of Bolivia. But after they pulled out, Bechtel then proceeded to sue the Bolivian government, and the case is ongoing, for $25 million for breaking the contract. Far from making governments more accountable to the public, under current trade rules, governments that respond to the wishes of their people are paying a steep price. Call it a democracy tax. The second problem with the idea that the private sector can make the public sector more nimble is a practical one. When services that used to be run by a city council are sold to a foreign multinational, and in most parts of the world, particularly the poorest parts of the world, it is always a foreign multinational, it does not create more responsiveness. On the contrary, it systematically increases the distance between the governors and the governed, between the decision makers and the people who have to live with those decisions. Suddenly, oceans and multiple borders are placed between the two. So if, for instance, the citizens of Tucumán, Argentina, want to talk about why Vivendi failed to install sewers as promised when they laid down the water pipes, and their cities are now teeming with waste, they need to take it up with executives in Paris. If the citizens of Buenos Aires want to know why they have the highest phone rates in the world with the worst service, they have to take it up with a company in Madrid, one that is legally accountable not to the citizens of Argentina, but to its shareholders. In theory, privatization was supposed to be a modernizing force in Latin America. Instead, it is seen as reproducing colonial relationships between the Americas and Europe, now expressed through the control of basic services rather than direct control of government. No wonder a recent poll published in the Financial Times found that the percentage of Latin Americans who believe that, quote, privatization benefits society has dropped from an already unimpressive 46% in 1998 to a dismal 28% today. The third reason to be skeptical of the idea that the private sector can make governments more accountable is perhaps a rhetorical one, which is post-Enron, WorldCom, et cetera. It's not clear at all that we should be attributing the qualities of efficiency and accountability to private corporations. Perhaps that argument belonged to a more euphoric, less skeptical age. In practice, what these policies have meant is a systematic centralization of power. It is in this context that representative democracy finds itself facing this global crisis of confidence, in which the basic trust required to delegate power upwards is being eroded at its core. When people stop voting and spoil their ballots, it's often called apathy. I think it might more accurately be called paying attention. Although this is a global crisis, the most dramatic example of this loss of faith is in Argentina, precisely for the reasons I described, because they were the IMF's model student, because they privatized everything, including their street signs. In the last Argentine elections, there were more spoiled ballots than there were votes for any single candidate, but the most popular write-in candidate was a cartoon character named Clemente. Now, Clemente doesn't have any hands, so he can't steal. But interestingly, while a vast majority of Argentines don't believe that there is a single party or candidate that can get them out of their economic crisis, they have not lost faith in democracy and are not returning to their history of authoritarianism. In fact, their faith in democracy has deepened since they began tossing out presidents by the barrelful last December. The problem is that the public's definition of democracy today has dramatically outpaced the definition of democracy held by their politicians and expressed in Argentina's weak electoral system. Now, when Argentina erupted into flames last December 19th and 20th, they went banging pots and pans, and that was when the first president fell, and there were four more in 2 weeks. The slogan on the streets was "Que se vayan todos," which roughly translated means "everybody must go," or "everybody out," or "fire the experts." It was a reaction not just to the entire corrupt political class, but a rejection of a vision of democracy that defines itself by more delegation, by more representation. What's become clear is that Argentines no longer trust those in power with anything that they care about, either their votes or their money, because they know it will likely get stolen. Once again, they've just been paying attention. And the state itself is in profound crisis. Argentine politicians can't walk down the street without being greeted with a symphony of pots and pans. And this is a democratic crisis, because the man who implemented many of these policies, Carlos Menem, ran on a fairly traditional socialist platform of wealth redistribution. And he actually once said that if I had told them what I was going to do, they never would have elected me. And this is a man who's well known for racing along the Argentine coastline in a bright red Ferrari Testarossa, which was given to him as a gift by the Argentine Business Council. So you can understand why people are a bit skeptical. The first night that I was in Buenos Aires, we walked around and we saw something that we didn't quite understand what we were seeing. We saw clusters of people after dark on street corners and parks and plazas. And I didn't realize at first what they were doing. Whenever you see clusters of 200 people, you think something interesting must be going on. What they were doing was they were voting. And what happened after they had their protests that are called the Cacerolazos in December is that they looked to each other and they said, what now? We've been through five presidents. What do we want in its place? Because this wasn't a classic revolution of just trying to get your political party in power. They were actually trying to out a system, but how do you do that? So they did something that was almost post-apocalyptic in its logic. They went out into the streets in a daze and talked to their neighbors for the first time. And this in a city that everybody says Buenos Aires is the Paris of Latin America, that had internalized the promise of the American dream under Menem, and where people were living very isolated lives in their homes. And they said when they went to their first neighborhood assemblies, they felt that they were leaving their house for the first time in 20 years. These neighborhood assemblies, there's two rules: no bankers, no politicians, or there's three, no flags. And it's a rejection of some of the left-wing traditions on the Latin American scene. So instead of calling each other compañero, they call each other vecino, which just means neighbor, to depoliticize their interactions with each other, to talk to each other as people. And the pots and pans that they started banging on the streets that first night, and actually that form of protest dates back to the dictatorship. The mothers of the Plaza de Mayo used them. The symbol was, we have nothing to eat, we have nothing, you have stolen everything from us. But now those same pots and pans are being used all over Argentina in hundreds of community kitchens with food that's being cooked through community gardening, community farming. There's been an explosion of cooperative action and organizing going on in Argentina, which has moved beyond protest and has started to look much like government. For instance, there are at least 150 factories that were closed during the crisis, Capital Flight, it's called. And the workers at these factories, not in a kind of Marxist, the workers must own the means of production, but more in a pragmatic, what are we going to do? The boss didn't show up to work, decided to run the factories anyway. Now there are 150 cooperative-run factories in the country. Some of them are quite profitable, and the proceeds from a couple of the factories have now gone to reopen hospitals. There's one hospital that has rehired 180 doctors. So you can see that it is more than protest. It's actually building a kind of a shadow state, born of necessity, but turned into something else, a vision of another way of doing politics. One of these amazing neighborhood assemblies meets on the steps of the National Congress. The National Congress, it looks a lot like the White House. It's a daunting building with Athenian pillars. And so they're having this little community meeting on the steps of this building, a couple hundred people. And we went to this neighborhood assembly the night before we left Buenos Aires. And we interviewed the people there about why they chose to meet there. It's like having a concerned parents meetings on the steps of the White House. And it was, because it wasn't a protest, it was a meeting. And we said, is it because you want to go in there? You want to take power? And they said, no, we don't want to go in there. We want them to come out here. We think they have something to learn about the way we're doing politics. So now the big question in Argentina is how to take that spirit and embed it in big P politics, if you will, in government, in democratic institutions, and whether that's even possible. There's one candidate who's quite high up in the polls for president. There's election scheduled for the end of March. It's not clear it's going to happen. This candidate's name is Luis Zamora, and Luis Zamora has decided that he wants to be the anti-candidate, and he's not going to run for president, and he is urging his supporters to spoil their ballots in a very specific way. He calls it the policy vote, where instead of voting for a candidate or a party, you write in the policy that you believe is needed to make that vote meaningful. So a few examples are participatory budgets, constituent assemblies, very short mandates, recalls, referendum. In this context, in this explosion of participatory grassroots democracy in the workplace, in the hospitals, in the schools, in the universities, the IMF actually can't come in and propose a new sweeping, centralized structural adjustment program for the whole country, because it's actually a way of being uncontainable, decentralization. Now, the IMF's line about Argentina is that its problems are hyper-specific. This country is so screwed up, so corrupt, that it has nothing to teach the world. There is nothing that is translatable about that crisis there that we could learn here. But I believe that what's happening in Argentina is just an exaggeration of the crisis in economic policy and representative democracy that we're seeing around the world, just with the volume turned way up. Now, that's not a reason to turn it out or block your ears. In fact, I think that that's a reason to listen very, very closely. Because precisely because of the depth of this crisis, because it is so extreme, because they have been forced to take such drastic measures, I believe that they are in the process of developing alternative policies that we have much to learn from. And I also think that there's some justice in this idea, because we've been telling Argentina how to run their country for 500 years, so maybe it's time that we listen to some ideas coming out of there. And this idea of participatory democracy is already spreading. It's probably most rooted in Brazil, where you have Porto Alegre, Brazil, the southernmost city, which has been using something called the participatory budget now for 13 years, and that has now spread to 200 municipalities. And much of the positive experience with this kind of participation, where people are able to vote on every single line item in their municipal budget, is what is propelling Lula up in the polls and the PT. The question is, and I think it's a very real question, whether Lula is going to bring the spirit of participatory democracy into centralized government, and I'm not sure about that at all. This spirit, though, is also coming north. The mayor of Paris has introduced a participatory mechanism. The same is true for the mayor of Brazil. Many social movements activists in Italy, the same people who were on the streets when the G8 met in Genoa, have started running for office in their cities and towns and winning seats in Rome, Milan, in Venice. And there's a similar experiment going on in participatory democracy here in England in the Manchester Community Network, which is a diverse grassroots group that uses deeply democratic and sometimes difficult consensus-making decisions, making methods. And it's building a social power base to fight the needs for the needs of poor communities in the business-friendly LSP, which is the local strategic partnership process, which I'm sure you all know much more about than I do. This idea is actually taking hold in the country where I live, in Canada. And Vancouver is currently in the middle of municipal elections, and there's a slate of activist candidates that is poised to win. And they have a twofold plan that I think is really interesting. The first is to revive our faith in democracy by introducing some of these participatory mechanisms like participatory budgets. But the other is to turn the city into a kind of an activist site, whereby engaged school boards and hospital boards organize and have so much support in their communities and in their constituencies that they're able to refuse to implement new rounds of spending cuts imposed on them by higher levels of governments, from the provincial government or the federal government. So you have a kind of a double strategy of radical participation in decision-making process and principled non-participation in advancement of these economic policies. The task is to take the spirit of direct action that we've seen glimpses of outside of summits and in Argentina, and find a way to embed it in the way we do politics day to day, root it in our communities on an ongoing basis. I did a public event last week here in London with Arundhati Roy, and she described the challenge or the goal facing all progressive movements around the world, whether they're fighting a World Bank-funded dam or whether they're fighting water privatization, as to narrow the distance between those making decisions and the people having to live with the effects of those decisions. And I think that that's as succinct a vision for what the task is in this context as any I've heard before. Now, that doesn't mean abandoning international and national rules and standards. You need rules and bodies to enforce them to ensure that real self-determination is possible for all and not just for a powerful few. Standards that prohibit gender or racial discrimination are a classic example of international and national rules that make real empowerment possible. Another is the right to form trade unions. The point is that in our discussion of democracy, we have to abandon the dichotomy of pro versus anti-globalization. Some international rules are clearly designed to centralize power, to create a one-size-fits-all logic that believe that a single model of governance can work everywhere. These are the rules that are most forcefully enforced and need to be most forcefully challenged. Other rules that are necessary to ensure the decentralization of power and the possibility of real democracy and empowerment happen to be the ones that are not enforced at all and which need to be strengthened and supported. In conclusion, I believe that the current debates about privatization, in these debates, we're given two unacceptable choices, and I'm gonna lay this out with another local example, which would be the case of the British Rails and the London Tube. In the case of the rails, you have a formerly public service that has been privatized and in the process been made less reliable, more dangerous, more out of touch with users and workers. In the case of the London Tube system, you have a system that, while appreciated by the public and public in name, is not necessarily publicly controlled. Its destiny often seems in the hands of a battle between government and union, and the people who use this asset are caught in the crossfire without a say. A way out, dare I call it a fourth way, is represented by a phenomenon that has cropped up in Los Angeles and also in Vancouver. It's the Bus Riders Union, which is not a replacement for a trade union, but an addition to it. It's this crazy idea that public services should be accountable to the people who use them. Along with workers, they should have a say in their transit routes, in hours, in schedules, in safety standards. And actually, this phenomenon was actually started in Vancouver by a group of pensioners who weren't happy with the way their bus routes were being arbitrarily changed without their consultation. The left has too often treated public ownership as an end in itself, a good in itself. Public ownership is not the end, it's the beginning, a foundation that makes building truly innovative, creative, and democratic public spaces possible. What makes an institution public is not who owns it, but who runs it, who uses it, and who feels a sense of ownership over it. In other words, the solution to an out-of-touch public institution is not privatizing it, it's not outsourcing it to experts. The solution is to crack it open and make it genuinely public. The solution to the crisis of credibility facing the public sphere and the state in general is not less democracy through privatization, but much, much more democracy, woven, as Ralph Miliband wrote, into, quote, the productive process in every sphere of life. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure Tony will have something to say in response to that. The gauntlet has at least partly been thrown down. So take 12, 15 minutes, Tony.
Let me say first of all that this is on, but very pleased to have Naomi here, whether she's rude to me or not. And when you run a public institution, this is a public institution. You get used to people being rude to you, but they're normally insiders rather than outsiders. Can I just clear up the story of the Miliband Fund, because I just have to say what Naomi said was not wholly accurate. The money came from an ex-student of the LSE, but me and the development office put an awful lot of effort into raising this money. I had a whole exchange of correspondence with the individual who gave this money. He's a really interesting man living in a hotel in Thailand. He seems to have given nearly all of his money to this program and left himself with hardly anything, and he died not long after. But it took a long exchange of letters with him. Dorothy Johnson from the development office nobly went to Thailand and talked to him about this. It didn't come spontaneously from the student body. Sometimes you need power from the top as well as from the bottom if you're going to generate money and resources. Moreover, what he said was, I was strongly influenced by Ralph Miliband's teaching because Ralph Miliband was such a great teacher, which he was. But he said, I never liked Ralph Miliband's politics. I was never a leftist. I never believed in leftism. He said, what I liked about Ralph Miliband was his radicalism. And radicalism, he said, is not a prerogative either of the left or the right. It's simply thinking radically. And thinking radically can often mean disavowing the ideas of the left. And that was the conditions under which he left this bequest. Naomi made so many points that I can't really respond to them in any detail, but I'll have a go on some of them. I had hoped this might be one occasion where I wouldn't have to mention the term third way, but it was not to be. And I feel I must say that as I understand the third way, which is simply an attempt to update left-of-center politics in order to win elections and to do decent things when you win elections, something the left has conspicuously failed to do in most countries most of the time, the third way does not stand for endorsement of privatization. That would be a ludicrous position. Third way, on the contrary, as I would see it, a modern social democrat, you stand for the defense of public institutions. Institutions like this. Well, look at this as a public institution. The LSE is a public institution, produces, I hope you'll agree, a lot of good public goods, including this particular public good we're producing here tonight. Well, the LSE now only gets 20% support from the state. The LSE is a public institution which has become increasingly detached from the state, demands effort from all of us to sustain it as an effective public good, which I feel we do. Now, what the third way is about is defending the public sphere. It argues for the renewal of the public sphere. It argues for the key importance of public institutions, whether this is local, national, or transnational. But it says, and I feel anyone, and Naomi seems to agree from what she said anyway, anyone who thinks this through would see that the public sphere cannot be identified with the state. And that was the prime mistake made by many on the traditional left. The state is often the enemy of the public sphere. It may be the friend of the public sphere, but it can be the enemy, especially where states are corrupt, where states, as was mentioned in the quotation that Naomi read out, are inefficient, are bureaucratic, are not responsive to their citizens, have special interests, including the interest of unions, which do not represent the general public interest necessarily. All these things must be contested. So I like to say, you had the state, right? You had privatization. Now we want a process of publicization, the recreation of the public sphere using different methodologies, both from the traditional left and the neoliberal right. And that's why the idea of a third alternative or a third way, if you like to use that term, makes some sense. Thirdly, I mean, I found what Naomi said about privatization really unconvincing. It is, to my mind, crass just to oppose privatization, just as crass it would be to defend the traditional state as a means of generating either economic justice or economic development. Privatization is sometimes effective and sometimes not. We know that it's not so effective when you're dealing with more monopoly-style industries, but there are many industries that have been privatized, for example, telecommunications industries in this country, which are much more efficient, much more responsive to citizens' needs, when they were than they were when they were a traditional bureaucracy. Privatization in its place can be effective both for democracy, for economic development, and for citizens' interests as well as consumers' interests. A key case in point is the case of the railways, I think, because Naomi mentioned that. I won't go into the tube because I haven't got enough time to talk about all of these things. The position of British railways in this country is not simply the result of privatization. I would remind you the best railway system in the world is fully privatized. There is therefore not a necessary incompatibility between having a really good railway system and privatization. Japan has fully privatized its railway system. Do you know what the average level of lateness of Japanese trains is? 1 minute. And they're trying to get it down to 30 seconds. And this is in a wholly privatized industry, which is arguably much more responsive to consumer needs and, I think, to the wider community than British Rail ever was. The problems of the railways in the UK date from 40 years of underinvestment. It was a botched privatization. We all know that. But you had a long, long period of underinvestment. During most of that time, the railway was nationalized. It was in the hands of the state. And neither Labour governments nor, well, Labour governments tried and Tory governments didn't try, but neither of them could persuade the Treasury to put adequate investment into the railway system. So whatever would have happened, whether the railway had stayed in the hands of the state or whether it had passed into private hands, you would have had major problems in the British railway system as we have today. And there is no short-term silver bullet solution to those problems. To suppose that renationalisation would solve those problems is ridiculous. And I think the idea of having, as the government does, a public interest corporation to run the railway is at least going to, I hope, be an effective stab at getting investment in there. You need investment and you need good management. You can't have decent public institutions unless you have both of those. I know, as someone who runs a university, you must have investment from somewhere and you must, I hope, have good management. And this applies, I think, to all public institutions. Fourthly, Naomi commented, I think, a bit on PPPs, which are collaborations between the public and private sector, not a classical example of privatization. Well, there are good reasons why you would seek to lock investment in for 30 years. One is it guarantees investment over a long-term period, something the railways never had. Why do the railways never have long-term investment? Partly because every year governments change the amount of money they spend. And you can't really plan. People running the railway system could never really plan it. Partly because you have a Labour government, which wants to put a bit of money in the railway. Then you have a Tory government, which takes it all away again. So this locks in patterns of investment, which will be there and which will guarantee investment over the long term. There can be problems with PPPs. That's also obvious. But they do other things. They specify risk, for example. Most public sector projects do not specify risk. That means when they go wrong, you and I don't know how many taxpayers there are in the room, but I see at least one taxpayer in the third row there. You and I, the taxpayer, we have to pick up the cost if things go wrong. Risk is diffusely picked up by the state sector if you don't specify it. And one of the advantages of at least the best kinds of PPPs is they specify risk, and the financial markets bear at least some part of that risk rather than just the public purse. Fifthly, let me say that I take it we can all agree the inequalities that exist in the world are scandalous. That the world cannot sustain itself if the level of poverty and the level of inequality that we see around us continues. I take it that everybody in this room would agree that it's important to have a sense of moral outrage at that. But the fundamental questions, really, are not the existence of poverty and the existence of inequality and the existence of failing states, but what you do about them. Now, experiments in participatory democracy may be helpful on a local level, but you know, we know from long experience that participatory democracy is limited. It can't deal with big questions involving millions of people. It needs stabilization because otherwise it can degenerate into a form of local populism run by local elites. Therefore, you must always have representative mechanisms which link up whatever participatory ones are possible. The problem is regularizing participatory democracy. No one has found a solution to having any more than a certain level of participatory democracy. You must also have representative democracy, and you must have a balance between national, in my view also transnational democratization, and local democracy. But participatory democracy is not going to supply a great deal of an answer. I think it's very important to stress that there is only one way that we know of in which we can leverage millions of people out of poverty. There is only one known way. And that way is economic development in which poor people participate. Now, of course, there are examples of that. The successful economies of East Asia have closed the gap with Western countries. They haven't done so through local participatory mechanisms. They haven't done so through IMF classical measures either. The state and government have been involved in all the successful examples of Asian economic development, but they have done so by engaging with the wider marketplace. There is no substitute for a poor country for engaging with the wider world economy. The key question is, what are the conditions under which you do this? A free market ideology does not provide the conditions under which poorer countries can prosper. If you have a country which is corrupt, which is poor, which is divided between traditional elites and an indigenous impoverished peasantry, it's not going to help to open up that economy to markets without making other structural changes. For poorer countries, the key questions, therefore, often concern reform of the state, attacking corruption, expansion of democracy, not just local democracy, but good, genuine parliamentary democracy, transformation of banking institutions, regularized financial system. Under these conditions, poor countries can prosper. We see that some of them are prospering. Of the 20 fastest growing economies last year, 7 of those economies were in Africa, but starting from a very low base. It's a complete mistake to blame most of these problems on globalization. If you mean by globalization the expanding interdependence of the world over the past 20 or so years. Many of the problems that have produced impoverishment, produced conflicts, come from the Cold War period. Cold War was fought out by the two superpowers as a proxy conflict in Africa, Central America, and elsewhere. We're living with a residue of those things. To these problems, there are no simple solutions, but there are solutions that can be effective, and I feel the most important ones are not really those which Naomi identifies in what she had to say.
Well, from the dream, from the chair's point of view, this is a dream platform because the issues are very clear and are well expressed by both sides. So, Naomi, do you want to come back on Tony's remarks first before we open it up to the floor?
Yeah, if I could. Sure. Well, I don't feel that Professor Giddens answered my core critique about.
I'll call you Naomi. You call me Tony. Okay.
All right. The core critique about privatization, which was its interference with democracy and its incompatibility with current trade rules. And I would agree with you that the only success stories that are currently available to defenders of these economic policies happen to be mostly communist countries, which presents some problems. In terms of poverty eradication, I mean, most poverty eradication that's taken place over the past couple of decades has been in China. The reason why there's this backlash against these policies in Latin America is because the promise of economic growth was delivered on, but the trickle-down didn't arrive. So you have countries like Bolivia that followed all the recipes, opened up their markets, got the investment, had fabulous growth rates of 5.5% a year of their GDP, and poverty actually increased. I don't think you can talk about this without talking about trade rules, because most countries, poor countries, are saddled with debt. This is what sets China and Malaysia apart, and why they don't make good case studies. Most poor countries are saddled with debt, and because of that debt, are subject to their privatization having to take place according to IMF structural adjustment programs and are members of the WTO, unlike China until recently, which means that they lose the right to change their mind. That's the biggest problem with privatization. I am not against privatization on principle in a crass way. I am pro-democracy, and I believe the two are incompatible if governments lose the right to learn from their mistakes. Vancouver was about to privatize its water sanitation system a few months ago, and the city council decided to back out of it at the last minute. They backed out of it not because they became rabid socialists. They backed out of it because they looked at the case studies of privatization elsewhere and realized that if it didn't work, they could get sued at the WTO under Chapter 11 of NAFTA. So I'm not talking about an abstract vision of privatization. I'm talking about the way it is implemented in practice. And I don't believe that, Tony, you answered those critiques. I also really reject the idea that privatization means that we lose our share in the risk. Look at what is happening in the United States right now. There's a new bailout for a private company every single day. And the airlines keep going back for more. So what we actually have is a system where we socialize the risk and privatize the profits. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have replies to all of that, but I think we should have questions, yes.
It was getting hot. It was getting a bit hot over there, so I've moved over here.
They shouldn't be for me, they should be for you.
So, I can see you all better for questions. We have roaming mics, and let's take them in clusters of five. Lots of issues to pursue. So, please, yes, lady over there.
Okay, this is a little bit off topic, but something that I was about the role that the black market is playing interdependently with the globalizing market. It's actually quite a big problem. And does privatization make that worse? Because the mafias kind of, and most of the larger mafias throughout the world have lost kind of their relationship with the governments, which privatization gives them a renewed relationship. So does that make it worse? And also, would not-for-profit privatization perhaps?
Okay, thank you. That's a clear question. Second, yes, please, over there.
Hello. I'd like to ask especially about Naomi's point on political parties and social movements and their relationship. Do you believe that political parties and state political parties and states can facilitate social movements and democracy movements, or are they in conflict?
Thank you. Yes, question here, and then the question up there. Yeah.
It seems to me that what's being advocated here is a renewed form of liberalism, and I'm curious
by whom.
Well,
by both,
especially
sides.
By Ms. Klein, but also by Professor Giddens. I guess let's just leave it general. I don't want to direct to who specifically. It's more the issue. I hear an argument on both sides that seems to place a lot of emphasis on sort of the underlying factors that support liberal democracy and liberalism in general. And I'm curious as to whether it's not those underlying factors that might in fact be a large part of the problem that we face today.
Thank you. And there's a question. Yeah, good. Is your mic working? There's another one coming to you straight away. Look at that. Mics everywhere. Good.
I wondered if Naomi Klein's perhaps in danger of romanticizing people getting by. It's great that people coming together in neighborhood committees to organize, food or whatever, or bartering, and I'm sure that's a lot of help, but what kind of radical political ideas are coming out of these neighborhood committees?
Mike, come. Wait.
I was wondering if I could ask you to find one construct which you both agree on, because I think you are actually talking about some of the same things, like openness of choice amongst the state.
Okay, well, that's five questions. Do you want to respond to some of those issues, and then we'll take another five?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll do it in reverse order. As I said in the lecture, I actually agree with quite a lot of the critique of the state that I've read in Anthony Giddens' writing. And I believe it's been the great failure of the left not to recognize the genuine anger at the state. And to respond to the rise of the right around the world, and this now I'm going back to the early 90s with just please to stop the cuts and let's go back to the way things were 3 or 4 years ago, as opposed to stepping forward with a kind of a visionary politics that would have rejuvenated our faith in the public sphere. Where I think we do part company is that I don't believe that the solution is for the public sphere to look more like the private sphere or to turn to the private sphere for funding. I think the solution is to actually try rebuilding the public sphere, in many cases build it from scratch in ways that make it genuinely democratic and accountable. I think it's something that we have only tried in very small ways. So we end up with a public that is public in name only and a left that doesn't speak to the rage at central planning. In terms of romanticizing people getting by, it's absolutely true that these experiments in Argentina began out of necessity. I mean, they were driven by hunger and desperation. But what's interesting about this stage is that it is currently in the process, and this is the country is facing federal elections, and the debate in the country is how to transform. My friend John Jordan is here, who said to me many years ago in an interview that we did that direct action is not just a last resort, it's a preferred way of doing things. That's what they're discovering in Argentina, that it did start as a last resort, but it has turned into a preferred way of doing things. And there's tremendous pride, actually, in a country that is being devastated by their local elites and by the international community in what they are building in the rubble and are starting to figure out what it would look like in terms of policy. You asked about concrete policy decisions. They're talking about constituent assemblies. They're talking about ways to challenge some of the mechanisms of representative democracy so it's not eliminated, but much less faith and trust is required. It's faith and trust that these politicians have not earned. The idea is to keep politicians on extremely short leashes so that they are given clear direction through constituent assemblies. They go out there, and if they don't do exactly what they say they're going to do, they're recalled. These are ideas that in northern countries are usually seen by the left as being right-wing populist ideas. And we have ceded the terrain entirely in North America to the right. Charter schools, decentralization, community control, these are all right-wing ideas. And the left is seen as not trusting people with any kind of power. And as I said clearly, I don't think that this is instead of standards, particularly as it relates to gender and race and labor, but the kind of standards that we need are standards that make that empowerment possible and that decentralization possible. I think for now that's all I'm going to say because I've gone on for a bit of a while.
If I'm going to be up here, I can't keep quiet all the time, though, even though...
We don't want you to keep quiet.
Well, I thought you did, because I thought I was just going to say one thing and shut up because people want to hear Naomi.
No,
I must say, I think what Naomi says is wrong, see. I mean, we all want reform of public institutions. We want to bring public institutions closer to the people. Decentralization is a good thing, although it's difficult to achieve. We have to overcome entrenched producer interests in public institutions. But to suppose that you could just have state funding for public institutions... it's just not feasible. And universities are a very good example of that. I mean, 25 years ago, only 7% of the population went to university in this country, and it could be a wholly state-funded system. Now you have nearly 40% of the population going to university. No way the taxpayer could support that whole endeavor. So you must have mixed sources of funding. It's not easy to reconcile them with the public criteria of universities, but it's necessary to do that. There is no university system in the world which can survive as a good university system wholly on state-supported funding.
Thank you. Well, it wasn't a complete answer to all the questions that were raised, but we'll take another five. Yes, over here, you've been waiting patiently.
I'd just like to ask, mostly Professor Giddens, but also both. Professor Giddens said earlier that the third way, as he understood it, doesn't stand for privatization. But if this is true, then why is the, well, I, in my experience, I don't know about the Labour government in this country, but why is the Labour government in this country privatized so many things, including PFIs in the hospitals and PPP on the tubes, if the third way doesn't stand for privatization?
Okay, thank you. Question down here.
Shall I just answer that briefly?
Please.
Because I'm not here to answer questions primarily, I think, and I have to leave the floor to Henry mainly. But I'm not just a knee-jerk defender of the Labour Party. Labour government's made lots of mistakes, and some of those do involve pushing privatisation too far. And they certainly took a long time to get round to the need to reconstruct public institutions effectively. So I wouldn't support all the things the Labour government's done by any means.
Okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to ask Naomi about what she thinks about Menin running for the again, and if you can sort of like see any prospect of what the outcome is going to be. Mm-hmm.
We clearly have a problem with that mic, so we might want to get rid of it. Question over here.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear you talk about participatory democracy. I'm not delighted to be represented as a new idea, since it seems to me it came out of the Port Huron Statement from the New Left in the early 60s and was an idea fought for very strongly in the student movement, in the community movements, and in the civil rights movement. So I think to forget that history is to forget the difficulties with participatory democracy, which I don't think are trivial, and I don't think they're implicit in the system, but I think it's the issue of human agency and how one can transform the conditions under which one lives and actually create working relationships that are transformative is not simple and is not straightforward. And I think that's where Tony comes in, because I think he's gone to a solution which looks like it taps into human agency via the third way, because it looks like by going to where the initiative is, you're able to do something. But actually, for me, the initiative that you're talking about is what needs to be put into participatory democracy. I hope that makes it clear.
Thank you. Up top, yeah.
We're told that there's no way that the public sector could, or the government could, fund a university entirely nowadays. And we're told that the money has to come from private. It's private money. Now, I want to question what we mean by private money. Surely that money comes from us. It comes out of pension funds. It comes out of the money we put into BP when we buy a petrol. It comes out of the extra tuppence we put on this from any, you know, private good we buy. It's still our money. Now, what strikes me about it is it's much less accountable now. And I wonder if I'm just being cynical if I say that 20 years ago, you say, this institution was entirely state-funded. Now 20% comes from the state. And during that period, this institution's moved from a very left-wing institution to one which is seen as centre-right.
Okay, that's a clear... Can you
is there any sort of correlation here?
Probably not.
This is a question for Naomi Klein. What do you see as the role of the private sector, who are the suppliers of a lot of the jobs worldwide? What is their role in a working participatory democracy?
Okay, and finally, gentleman over there? Yeah. Well, there are two of you, so one of you, you'll resolve it in a little participatory democracy up there. This is a classic problem. Participation is going to solve it, so how are you? Or you can have half a question each.
I'm going to have half a question. Naomi, have you read Michael Albert's work on participatory economics, and if so, what do you think of it?
Okay, and the last point?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, Naomi was talking a lot about Argentina and its awakening. Que se vayan todos. Well, it seems now that it's que se vuelvan todos, because Carlos Menem, of course, looks like he's up and running for the new presidency and he's got a lot of support. I was just going to say, on a basic level, participatory democracy seems very well, but Latin America is very well aware that democracy doesn't function at a grassroots level. It functions on a wider level, IMF level based. Doesn't that kind of make impotent the civil society?
Okay, thanks a lot. Okay. Who's going to, Naomi, start first? Mm-hmm. Briefly.
Wow. I was asked about Menem running again, which you also mentioned. It's not clear that he has the leadership of the Peronist Party. He's running for the leadership of the Peronist Party, and he may not win. But he, you know, it's why I'm interested in these elections, to be honest, because to me you have these two incredible poles of Menem, who comes from this tradition of presenting himself as really not just a savior, but almost an otherworldly type figure. With all the plastic surgery, he even kind of looks like an otherworldly figure. And he, you know, his message is believe, have faith. It is quasi-religious. This is an extremely Catholic country that has always believed in saviors of various kinds, whether it's Evita or Che, who came from Buenos Aires, or the middle class often resorting to a belief in authoritarian measures. The 1976 coup was welcomed by the middle class in Buenos Aires as a way to bring back order. So there is this deep, deep authoritarian history. Carlos Menem represents it more than any living person in Argentina, and there will be a very, very stark choice because he is running up against not another savior candidate of the left who is the next Hugo Chavez, the next Fidel Castro, or even the next Lula. I mean, this guy who I'm talking about, Luis Zamora, who's quite high in the polls, you walk down the street with this guy and he gets, you know, begged to run for president and to be Chavez, to be the kind of strong hand. And he says, go to your neighborhood assembly because I can't save you. And I do believe that although it isn't, you know, a kind of a magic bullet in terms of a response to the International Monetary Fund, that this decentralization of power is the only hope that a poor country, a deeply indebted country like Argentina, has in the face of the International Monetary Fund, because it is precisely the centralization of power that makes it possible for somebody like Lula to enter into a backroom deal, as seems to have already happened in Brazil. You know, to agree to economic continuity no matter what people decide during the elections. When people are really engaged in their communities, I think they become less containable. And, you know, this is what we've seen. I mean, the IMF has said to Duhalde, I want 60% cut, not of your federal government, but of the provincial governments. I get the provinces in line. So when that decentralization of power happens, people are less controllable. And I think that it's their best defense in the face of these forces. Of course, it's an old idea. It's older than the 60s. It's the basis of Aboriginal self-government. It's the oldest idea going. So I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. But I recognize that. I still believe that it wasn't truly tried in the 60s, except in very small scale sort of experiments that were more sort of communal and movement-based, not so much community-based and place-based. And maybe that's part of the problem. It ended up being tried by a bunch of activists instead of communities. And activists tend to eat each other alive. At least that's my experience. Okay, thanks.
Tony, please.
Can I just make a couple of comments? Because participatory democracy, I mean, the most country where that's most developed often thought to be Switzerland, because it has high degree of localism. You only need a few thousand people to reach a referendum. And it's one of the most conservative countries in Europe. So it shows you that even when you have institutionalized participatory democracy, which I would have thought is the only kind which has any long-term stability, doesn't guarantee you adequate steering of the wider society. So you always need a balance between national democracy and local democracy, always. I'd just like to demur with what you said about the LSE, young fellow, up the back there.
What's your name?
Yeah, what's your name? Come down here, yeah. The LSE, yeah. I'm afraid to say, or I'm pleased to say, has always covered all parts of the spectrum. So the time when people associated with the LSE's high point of radicalism, a whole range of deeply conservative figures teaching here. Some of those very famous figures in politics and elsewhere. And von Hayek taught here, who was the main inspiration to Mrs. Thatcher, and according to Naomi, would have produced the very world that we see before us. The LSE has always spanned all aspects of the political spectrum and must do so. It is not a political institution. It's an institution where political ideas can be discussed. And that's the whole point. The guy gave the money because he was a right winger, but he admired Ralph because of his critical spirit.
Thank you. Well, we can move on to another cluster, yes. A taxpayer, as Tony was signaling earlier.
Good question that troubles me about Naomi's thesis is whether participatory democracy is suitable for wealth creation. Because after all, you've had participatory democracy in primitive societies, in British agriculture until the nasty enclosure movement came about. So aren't you, and in, of course in Argentina, you'll have participatory democracy when things have really broken down. So aren't we just replaying a social system that has already been superseded by capital accumulation?
Thank you. This will be the last cluster of questions, so get them.
Just a short question. The idea of participatory democracy, I find it very compelling, very interesting, and wanted to ask Anthony Giddens if what he thinks of an idea that democracy is more of a process that is developing over time from, for example, representatory democracy towards bringing closer of the people who are ruled upon and those who are ruling, and in the end bringing them so close together that it is participatory democracy. But what is needed is, of course, this development and this change and the people that learn how to deal with it.
That's the question.
And that
it's becoming a process. I mean, it's a question already. Do you want to just bring it to an end? Just to
things,
cut it.
Okay, things have changed, so maybe it has not worked in the 70s, but might not now work. So
all right, thank you very much.
Sorry.
Please. Mic over here.
I always used to tease these lectures at the London School, so where we get ecstasy. Today I got a CK speaker, perfume CK speaker. The question about, madam, I would like to get a street report from South Africa. In the last lecture, one of you students questioned about the way how we negotiate with the Osama Mullah Omar et al. So now the thing is, there was a vigilante group in South Africa, I think the Islamic-based one. So because of the terrorist in your terror and democracy is both there in South Africa. Do you think that is there a link between, of course, now we know that there is a link between Al-Qaeda and whatever is happening in Indonesia. Do you think that this terror could spread to South Africa? Because we don't know how much economic loss in the September 11th, but still the Western governments are not willing to pull up the democracy everywhere. So I just wanted to get your opinion about this extension of terror. Thank you.
Okay, two final questions before I ask the speakers to sum up. Yes, you up there, and then lady over here.
Yes.
Thank you.
Naomi, I'd like to know what you think about this student audience here. Are they people that connect with their neighbourhoods while they're at the LSE? Are they people that know their neighbours if they live in private accommodation? Do they want to make a difference with their lives in that way? Or are they people that want to work in high-profile public institutions, non-governmental organisations, high-status business companies?
And the question is, we got the drift.
What does she think they will do? You know, will they connect in deep democracy?
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Over here.
I wanted to ask both Naomi and Professor Giddens whether they see that e-government and proliferation of technology and much better connections around the world are one way to increase really the global participation, and in what way they see that being a good new movement and development.
Thank you very much. 2-3 minutes each, Naomi.
Okay. The first question was whether democracy is a substitute for wealth creation. There was another question that I didn't answer about what the role of the private sector would be. There is wealth creation going on within these structures of participatory democracy. There are these factories that have been turned into workers' cooperatives. Because the people who own the factories were way behind on back taxes and utility bills, in several of the cases now, their assets have been expropriated and they have now been turned from illegal squatted factories into official workers' cooperatives by the Buenos Aires municipal government. So they've been legalized, just as, you know, squats in New York have recently been legalized by Bloomberg, of all people. He calls it sweat equity, because people occupied buildings and transformed them, and there's a crisis in affordable housing. So one of the things that's interesting about one of these occupied factories that I visited, which was a clothing factory, was that they were turning a profit, they were diversifying, they were more profitable than when they were owned by a single owner. And in terms of what the role of the private sector should be in these contexts, I really believe that public-private partnerships and this whole model is a way to reject regulation. I saw it during the Johannesburg summit, during the Earth summit, and we saw it in the Rio summit, where there was a very, very clear quid pro quo from the companies that came to the table in Rio and stayed there and expanded their influence through the United Nations, where they said, we will enter into these public-private partnerships, we will donate money to your universities, we will do all kinds of good deeds out of the goodness of our hearts, but you cannot regulate us. And that's the deal. And I believe that there is a role for the private sector, but it should be regulated. It should be subject to our democracies. Some people do say that what's happening in Argentina is that it is going kind of medieval. I mean, you also have these explosion of trading clubs, barter clubs, which are called troikas. And I don't believe it is just nostalgic or going back in time. In fact, there's a tremendous amount of pride there in building something really new. And in fact, activists and even politicians from around the world have been flooding into Buenos Aires since December to study this experiment that has gotten absolutely no play in our newspapers, because it is a democracy laboratory and some really interesting policy is going on among an extraordinarily educated population. You asked about the students at the LSE. The people who've come to visit me during my office hours have been lovely. And I'm going to answer this question because I do believe that the issue is not just referendums, it's not just participation. It's what is spreading around Latin America comes from indigenous communities, a lot of it from the Zapatistas, where the center of participation is not the ballot box, but the meeting place, the encuentro. And the point of that, I think, has something to do with the idea of e-government being the solution, because I think there is a role for electronic participation. But the point and the experience is that when people meet face to face, when they meet the people who they affect through their policies and through their voting, something actually changes in them. They have a deeper sense of social solidarity, and they start to vote in ways that are not reflected in Switzerland's experience. They vote in ways that are not necessarily in their direct self-interest. This is what they found in Porto Alegre, that people are voting in redistributive ways because they're meeting people who live in the poor favelas, and they're deciding that it is in their common self-interest to build a more just society. And I don't think that e-participation can replace that. And I also think that meeting your neighbors and building community is really the major task, more than confronting capital, although that's a big part of it, of any movement for social change right now, because the most profound effect of these economic policies that Ralph Miliband called capitalism, and we call neoliberalism sometimes, and the French call savage capitalism, is a process of isolation. And that isolation affects everyone, rich and poor. Now, if you're poor, that isolation may take the form of, you know, you work for a private company and you get laid off and you're embarrassed because you can't feed your family anymore, so you end up drinking and watching television alone in your house and you lose your community. Or maybe you live in a valley that's being submerged by a mega dam and you start moving from countryside to city and you lose your roots and you're hypermobile. Or maybe you live in a rich city like London and your problem is not underemployment but overemployment, of overwork. But that same isolation is common. That is what's common globally. And that process of rebuilding community, not in a nostalgic way, but in a genuinely cosmopolitan, multi-ethnic, and global way, because we live in global cities. So knowing our neighbors is a revolutionary act. Thank you.
I just comment briefly because I suppose I do fundamentally disagree with quite a lot of that, actually. And, you know, when I see Argentina, I would like Argentina to be more like Spain, because in the 1950s, Argentina had a GDP per head of $4,000. Spain had one of about $2,200. Now the GDP head per head of Spain is six times as high as Argentina. And economic policies have basically been pretty similar. So quite a lot of things that happened in Argentina are certainly due to the internal structure of the country, not just its peripheral position in the wider world economy. And you'd be, I think, quite wrong just to blame it on those things. Second, I think, the advent of the internet, the relationships, has in a way already transformed world democracy, because that's what Naomi's in a way doing here, because the rise of the NGOs, even the rise of whatever you want to call it, anti-globalization movement or movement for global social justice, very much influenced and mobilized through new electronic technologies. And NGOs can now keep a much closer eye on what corporations and governments do than they could ever do before. You must have provisos about that, because NGOs are unelected. No one gave the anti-globalization movement a mandate, so far as I know. NGOs themselves can become like second order Western organizations, so you have like a double order Western influence through NGOs, or all those kinds of problems. But I think on the whole, the world is becoming more transparent, and this severely limits the power of corporations, I think. It creates a new environment in which they act, and this is, on the whole, a democratic outcome. I'm much more skeptical of how far e-democracy can transform traditional parliamentary democracy. That remains to be seen, but so far, not many people have taken advantage of the opportunities offered in recent elections in Europe or the US, so there would be a long way to go if it was going to have a transformative effect there. It may do, but we don't really know at the moment. As far as the LSE goes, well, I mean, I think LSE has traditionally trained lots of people who've had very worthy social objectives, who have integrated with their local communities, certainly talked to their neighbors and other people's neighbors too. And I think the LSE's trained many, many people who've had a very, to my mind, praiseworthy reformist and even revolutionary attitude towards the world. But I think the LSE also has to train other people. You need people to run businesses. You need people to take part in orthodox government. You could not reduce economic development or a society to the kind of things that Naomi is talking about, which could only be one aspect of them. So the LSE must do all of these things simultaneously. But I would like to thank Naomi for coming. I found it a very stimulating evening. I hope that everyone else has as well.
Well, and that, before we clap, just four thank yous. A thank you to the spirit of Ralph. And if you're here, I think he certainly would have appreciated. Thank you to our speakers for extremely stimulating and engaging discussion, which can't help but provoke further thought. Thank you for the participatory audience for being here and engaging so willingly. And finally, thank you for the rulemaking chair, which shows that essential rules are in a condition of public discussion.
And thank Professor Held, who put an awful lot of effort into organizing this Miliband series, although he's too modest to say so.